Many decry how ugly politics have become. Gone the passionate, though reasoned discourse, the respectful disagreement. But is what we have now really so different from the past? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa Week continues, looking at topics through the prism of then and now. Today, we examine political discourse and civility over time with historians Tim Walsh and Tom Moraine. Also, former Congressman Jim Leach joins us a little later with his thoughts about changing political civility. And Iowa State University's Rachel Rubel comments on the impact of online communication. Political discourse and civility, then and now. First, this news. Many decry how ugly politics have become. Gone the passionate, though reasoned discourse, the respectful disagreement. Wasn't there a time when the focus was on the common good? A time when differences could be worked out, compromises reached? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa Week continues, looking at topics through the prism of then and now. Today, we examine political discourse and civility over time. Joining us this first half hour, Tim Walsh is with us in our Iowa City studio, presidential historian and director emeritus of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Tim Walsh, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Ben.
Tom Moraine joining us by phone, historian and director of government relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. Tom, welcome to you.
Thank you very much. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Tom.
This first part of our program, we want to have you to take us through the past, 70 or 80 years with an eye on political discourse, ask how it's changed, if our present political discourse is really so much coarser than decades past. Let me start with you, Tim Walsh. So much of the focus these days seems to be on self-interest, ideology,
right,
the demonization,
right,
of those with whom we disagree. Are we at the pinnacle of this sort of nasty political discourse? Or I guess it sure feels like it.
Well, except that we go back to the 18th century and politics has almost from the beginning of the Republic been pretty nasty. It is true, however, in the last 20 years or so, we seem to have gone from the idea that we had political opponents who were good people with bad ideas to just saying they're bad people.
Mm.
And so we're vilifying just about anybody who doesn't agree with us. And there are probably a multiple number of reasons. People often point to social media, and I know you'll be talking about that in the future. But we shouldn't forget that, of course, back in the 18th and 19th centuries, we had newspapers that would take one political viewpoint. And in fact, I just want to read a real quick little comment here. Back when Thomas Jefferson was running, he was accused of being a mean-spirited, low-lived fellow, the son of a half-breed Indian squaw, sired by a Virginia mulatto father. So you've thrown a lot of words in there that cast blame. John Adams was considered a hideous, hermaphroditical character, which has neither the force or firmness of a man nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. So there's some pretty nasty comments out there about our founding fathers, people like Adams and Jefferson. So we shouldn't immediately assume that what's happening today doesn't have roots in the past. We know that politics, as Martin Dooley, the famous Chicago saloon keeper, said, politics ain't beanbag. We have to be careful.
When we bring it into the 20th century with the advent of mass media,
right,
we have the advent of the attack ad. When did that come?
Well, you know, you can probably trace attack ads back to the earliest days, not so much the earliest days of television, because Dwight Eisenhower's commercials were fairly positive. And, you know, I like Ike and they sang jingles. But we recall in 1964 – Barry Goldwater was running for president, and he had said that extremism in the defense of liberty was no vice. And the Democrats took advantage, I think, of people's apprehension about Goldwater as a candidate and ran an ad for just one time, as far as we know, and it went viral in 1960s terms. People will remember a little girl picking the petals off a daisy, and she's counting one, two, three, and then all of a sudden it morphs into the countdown for an atomic bomb. And, you know, all it said was, I think, vote Democratic. But I'll bet you
there are
people.
Well, let's listen to it. We have that ad. Okay. This ad aired, as Tim Walz said, only once, September 7th, 1964, in the campaign between President Johnson and Barry Goldwater, drawing widespread criticism, pulled immediately after, but had in that day some sort of a viral life after that. Let's listen to this. This is called the Daisy Girl ad from 1964. Right.
Either love each other or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
So no subtlety there, Tim Walz.
not at all, like a ton of bricks. And I'll bet you there are listeners out there, of course, they're just hearing the audio, but they have in their mind a visualization of that commercial. And in fact, I think even if they didn't see it on September 7th of 64, it has been reused in documentaries, and it's become part of our political history. A single ad run a single time. It's quite probable that Barry Goldwater didn't stand much of a chance running in 1964 for president. But that cemented the image of Goldwater perhaps as being reckless.
Mm-hmm. So one of the earliest attack ads.
Yes, I would certainly say. Certainly using television or radio, there are ads going back, you know, before the war. And it's also true that when Harry Truman ran for president of the United States, he gave speeches on his whistle stop tour and widely attacked his opponent. Tom Dewey is the man on the wedding cake, of course. He accused the Republicans of running a campaign that would take us back to the Hoover Depression. And if you want to back the train into the station. And when President Hoover came to the White House after the campaign, he said to President Truman, "Mr. Truman, I didn't very much like those speeches you gave," and he said, "I know, Mr. President. Somebody else wrote them, and I just had to read them."
Tim Walz is with us. He's Director Emeritus of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum and Library. One of our guests this first half hour, as we look at how political discourse has changed in over the course of, I guess, the 20th century into the 21st century, where we are today. We're starting on that path. If you'd like to join us, we have a little idea that we'd like to use our social media with. In five words or less, we want you to tell us, characterize politics and civility today. Five words or less, go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Five words or less, characterize politics and civility today. We're still in the past, talking about how we got to today. Tom Moraine is with us as well, historian, director of the government relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. Tom, give us a more local view of what Tim's been talking about, Iowa's political history in this context. Was there a similar coarsening as we went through the 20th century into today?
Do I get more than five words?
Yeah, please. You get a bounty of words, as many as you need.
I liked what Tim said about the difference between issues. We've had many campaigns where the issues have been very hard fought, but the demonization of the opponents, that I think comes and goes in politics. And I can give a local example that's one of my favorites. When my dad first entered the newspaper in the mid-1930s, there was an old curmudgeon dyed-in-the-wool Republican editor that he worked with. There were two newspapers, and the curmudgeon was on one of them. And there was a young, bright Democrat lawyer that would come into Editor Lovejoy's office and bait him in the morning. And Vic Lovejoy would get pounding his desk, and his face would turn red, and he would be so adamant about the dangers of the New Deal legislation. And then the lawyer would leave, and Vic would turn to Dad and say, "Boy, I like that young man." now there is a sense of where the issues were divisive, but the community ties, the sense of the opponent is not the devil incarnate, where that comes through. And I think what we're trying to look at is, has that community base, that social capital that Iowa has had so richly in the past, is that eroding?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the issue that I think needs to be on the table.
Right, and we're all aware of this, I guess, rather modern term, Iowa nice. Does that translate, Tom Moraine, into Iowa civility through the decades in politics? What's your answer to that?
I think many people say we are generally reluctant to talk about politics and religion in some public settings because we don't want to raise divisive issues. That's been a comment from outsiders. Sometimes that is described as nice. Sometimes it's described as bland. And those who are used to having knockdown, drag-out debates at the drop of a hat as just the norm, and it is not seen as derogatory to your opponent, find that our conversation is not very stimulating because we don't allow those divisive issues to include. I think I'd ask the listeners today, do you have someone who is a close friend or associate with whom you can honestly discuss political issues,
mm-hmm.
With someone you know has different views, and in a public group you can raise those issues and have a free-flowing debate? If you don't, then maybe that's a mark that our politics has entered a restrictive phase that we don't share the diversity of thought, that we tend to do that with our own only. We gather with our own and then demonize the opponent.
Right, and we've seen this trend in recent decades, a sort of self-sorting according to political attitudes, neighborhoods. People will pick out a new house and then get a sense of what the political attitudes are on the street, Tim Walsh?
Well, their sense of reality is sometimes shaped by the social media, by the websites they read, by the television cable news they watch. If they live in a world that's predominantly conservative, let's say they listen to Rush Limbaugh and watch only Fox News, you begin to presume that this is the reality and that everyone who doesn't agree with you or with what they're hearing is outside the pale. And rather than considering, as Tom suggests, there may be alternatives, maybe those that don't necessarily appeal to the individual but are worthy of consideration, they just don't associate with them. And as mm-hmm. you suggest, they live in certain areas. They only associate with people who share the same views that they have. We sometimes call this stovepiping. And so we don't have, in spite of all the social media and all the cable television news and channels and discussion that we have, we are not communicating. We are not listening. We're shouting at one another. And so in that sense, you don't have the discourse and the civility that is necessary to have useful discourse.
Mm-hmm. Tom, yeah. It was stovepiping, pigeonholing, whatever you want to call it. You see that?
Yes, I think many of us are guilty of that at times. I will be interested in what Congressman Leach has to offer, because he was a real leader in the National Endowment for the Humanities to encourage open public discourse.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was a recognition that something is missing. And to pick up on Tim's comment, social media allows us, because there is such a such an array, social media allows us to choose people who are like us to be comfortable with. If we don't like the view, we can find somebody on social media or a news channel that is congenial to our views, and that is who we tend to listen to. It's not a different voice that would expand our position. It is someone that would confirm our position, and then the quality of social or of political discussion constricts.
Two historians with us this first half hour: Tom Moraine and Tim Walsh. We want to challenge you. Five words or less characterize politics and civility today. We'll be sharing some of those answers a little bit later in the hour. It's Iowa Week. We're talking about political discourse through a prism of time over the last 70, 80, 90 years. How political discourse has changed? Has it become coarser? Is that better or worse? What effect does it have on the fact that we, through this democracy, govern ourselves through the system that we have? Let's go back, Tim Walsh, to campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
There's another significant moment that we could bring up in 2004, John Kerry running for president.
Kerry is a war hero. He won the Silver Star. He served in the U.S. Navy on what have now been called swift boats. I think they were PT boats on the rivers in Vietnam. And he rightfully used his military service as an indication of his patriotism, his love for his country. And he found very quickly that the Republicans turned it on its head and made accusations against him as overstating his military service and his campaign. And I know veterans were outraged. Many, many veterans were outraged at the way John Kerry was treated. But once those ads started to get out and they were funded by those who were supporters of the president at the time, you know, it's hard to take that back. And much like the Daisy ad, you know, once it's been done, it's out there and cemented in people's minds.
Let's remind ourselves by listening back to this is one portion of a Swift Boat ad. It's paid for by Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, not authorized by the candidate or George Bush.
That's true.
It's a super PAC.
Super PAC. Right.
And so let's listen to this run in the 2004 election between John Kerry and President George W. Bush.
And if you have any question about what John Kerry's made of, just spend 3 minutes with the men who served with him 30 years.
I served with John Kerry.
I served with John Kerry.
John Kerry has not been honest about what happened in Vietnam.
He is lying about his record.
I know John Kerry is lying about his first Purple Heart because I treated him for that injury.
John Kerry lied to get his Bronze Star. I know. I was there. I saw what happened.
His account of what happened and what actually happened are the difference between night and day.
John Kerry has not been honest.
And he lacks the capacity to lead.
When the chips were down, you could not count on John Kerry.
John Kerry is no war hero.
He betrayed all his shipmates. He lied before the Senate.
And John Kerry betrayed the men and women he served with in Vietnam.
He dishonored his country. He most certainly did.
I served with John Kerry. John Kerry cannot be trusted.
Swift Boat Veterans for Truth is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
Okay, and thus the verb was born to swift boat
to
someone.
To swift boat, that's right. And he betrayed the country. I mean, my goodness, if you were to translate this into charges, you'd think you'd bring him up on treason or desertion or almost any number of other things. I mean,
baseless, these charges, was said?
Certainly. I don't want to dispute what these people were saying and accuse them of being liars, but they had a point of view that they were pushing. And the question is how you interpret what it is that they're basing this on. Once you begin to generalize based on what one individual believes, you know, it sort of worms its way into your thinking. And, of course, John Kerry found himself on the defensive, having to to reiterate what his service was. But I can guarantee you that Purple Hearts and Bronze Stars and Silver Stars aren't given out just as a matter of politics or casual service.
Mm-hmm. This is an email that just comes in from Bonnie in West Branch. Tweeted this to Tim. You would like to probably respond to the Hoover presidential campaign against Al Smith, so nasty in its anti-Catholic smears that religious leaders joined forces to establish a National Brotherhood Week, seems to be forgotten, writes Bonnie in an email by historians. Most people seem to think that John F. Kennedy was the first Catholic to run for the president.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, when Al Smith ran for president, there was a picture of him dedicating, I think it was the Lincoln Tunnel in New York, and there was a caption underneath it that said this was a secret tunnel that Al Smith had dug to the Vatican so that the Pope could come to the United States as soon as he was elected president. I mean, there were ridiculous things out there that were said of Al Smith. And in fact, there's a wonderful accusation. He was challenged about certain ideas in one of the Pope's encyclicals. And Smith turned to one of his associates and said, "What the hell is an encyclical?" I mean, most Catholics didn't really process what the Pope was saying. So the bottom line is, yes, in any campaign, you're going to find people doing opposition research, so to speak, and certainly even back as 1928.
Right. Tom Moraine, we're coming up to the end of we've got a couple minutes left. What else did you want to throw into the pot here as we discuss political discourse and how it's changed over the last few decades?
I was just thinking how quaint and how old-fashioned Adlai Stevenson's comment was, "If you're slinging mud, you're losing ground." That was done in one of his presidential campaigns in the 1950s, and it sounds very, very dated in today's world. I'd pick up on what Tim was talking about the 1920s, certainly. And the Protestant-Catholic division in the state is one of the major social cleavages where we were just coming out of a decade where Iowa had an active Ku Klux Klan had active Ku Klux Klan chapters. And 4 years later, we have a Catholic running for president. So that residue was there, and all of the negative mythology that extreme right-wing Protestants were throwing at Catholics does get entered into the political discourse, because politics is where we seek to affirm our own positions. The status of who's in control is sometimes equally as important as the actual policy that comes out. So I don't think we're ever going to get it where we simply look in cold light at the policies or the impact of policies themselves. It says a lot about who we want to affirm as in charge, what values we want to believe that are running things. So the politics of status and the politics of who's in charge have always been with us, and they probably always will be. But that doesn't mean that you can't find common ground with those who might disagree.
Mm-hmm. One would hope so. Just 10 or 15 seconds, Tim, do you want to wrap up with anything, the concluding remark?
Well, no, I think we need to always temper our current concerns about the incivility in politics with the knowledge that it has gone on as part of American history. And to quote Finley Peter Dunn again, or Martin Dooley, politics ain't beanbag, and it's not for women or children or prohibitionists, as he said.
All right, Tim Walsh is Director Emeritus of the Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Tom Moraine, Historian, Director of Government Relations at Graceland University in Lamoni. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us. Coming up in just a moment, after a short break, former Republican U.S. Congressman Jim Leach served 30 years in the U.S. Congress. We'll have his perspective on civility and political discourse when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Stay tuned for more of Iowa Week. It's Iowa Week here on River to River, also on Talk of Iowa with Charity Nebbe at 10 o'clock. All this week, examining how things in our lives, big things, have changed over time. And today, looking at how political discourse and civility have changed over our lifetimes, going back a few generations to discuss what's different about our political communication and what difference it makes. We want to reach out to you this hour with five words or less, characterize politics and civility today. Politics and civility today, characterize that in five words or less. We have a number of answers already that have been turned in, some good ones. Cacophony of spin for marketing, one of the answers. Weston tweeting, public vilification, private cooperation fails. Join us on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or tweet us at IPR Talk, or send us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Joining me now, former U.S. Congressman Jim Leach served the state of Iowa in Washington from 1977 until 2007. After that, chaired the National Endowment for the Humanities. Now, skipping over a number of signposts there, but now a visiting professor at the University of Iowa College of Law in our Iowa City studio. Congressman Leach, welcome back to our program.
Well, good to be with you.
Well, you heard the first half-hour conversation. You served in Congress for three decades. I can't think of a better person to turn to give us a perspective on political discourse and the changes you witnessed firsthand being a member of Congress.
Well, there have been a lot of changes. Many of the changes have been gradual. And the gradual changes, there is a philosophical term that sometimes a difference in degree at a point becomes a difference in kind. And there really has been a difference in kind. There are always differences of opinion. They can be expressed in many different ways. But one of the things I always like to stress is that argumentation itself is a social good. Without argumentation, you have a tendency to dogmatism, and in politics, even tyranny. And so you want to have a good argument. The question really becomes when you deal with the problem of civility is whether or not anyone is willing to listen to someone else and take their views into consideration. And in America, we began with the premise all men are created equal. And based on that premise, one would presume that everyone's view is deserving of being listened to and hopefully to as large a degree as possible respected. My own impression of the United States Congress is that there is very seldom an issue in which someone with a different point of view can't add a new dimension to. And often with an issue, there are ways to accommodate. Sometimes there's no capacity to compromise, and sometimes that's correct. I mean, it's hard to compromise on an issue of civil rights sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Right. What about this idea, though, that we feel has happened to us over the past couple of decades, that today, more often than not, politicians are simply self-interested, putting party above common good, have lost sense of practical solutions, are instead focused on party power?
Well,
is that true from the inside view as well?
The conclusion is true. My personal sense is most people in politics are pretty decent people. On the other hand, the new processes of governance lead to a low road, and that becomes the most followed. And the argumentation for a politician is if others are doing it, I have to do it. And based on that, you have problems, particularly conflicts of interest. And some of the worst things in politics are not the words. Some of them are extraordinarily polite. And let me explain what I mean.
Sure.
In Congress, for example, there's a lot of walking back and forth between the House floor and a congressional office. And along the way, there are very nice people, well-dressed, polite, who are called lobbyists. And they might address a congressman, say, Joe, we have an important issue coming up tomorrow. We sure hope you're going to be with us. As you know, we maxed out for you in the last campaign. We hope to in the next. And by the way, how are your wife and kids? That's exceptionally polite. But the implication is that the politician owes something to the person who just said that.
You're paid for in some sense.
That's right. There's no reference to the common good. There's no reference to this is why it's important, just that it's important to the interest group, and you're part of that interest group. Now, what's happened is that interest groups are increasingly using politicians somewhat as pawns, and politicians are using interest groups to advance their personal ambition. So you have two sets of self-servingness, again, having nothing to do with the common good. And it has been exacerbated by the Supreme Court and its rulings on campaign financing that corporations can do based on linguistics that are truly dubious. That is, the notion that money is speech and that a corporation is an individual. Based on those two premises, a corporation should be allowed to have total freedom of speech, which means total giving of money, which is absolutely preposterous. And it's a Supreme Court that has made, in my judgment, the second worst error in its history. Now, the worst error will never be matched, and that was the 1857 Dred Scott decision where it said that a class of people were property. Mm. What this ruling, by the way, is logically the inverse. It says a class of property, that is corporations, are individuals. And neither ruling logically makes sense. The first, that is Dred Scott, is worse than the second, but the second is very bad for society, and it enhances all of the things about incivility that people don't like. Among other things—
For instance?
For instance, if you were a candidate and you say – and you're running against me and you say something negative about me, the fact is people say, well, maybe that's a little bit negative about you for saying it. However, if a third party comes in and says something negative about me,
right,
you don't tie awfulness to the third party. You say maybe they have something that's truthful.
I see.
So
there's no potential backlash when it comes from a third party for a candidate.
That's true. Well, it's much less.
Mm-hmm.
And the candidate can always deny responsibility. On the other hand, the candidate becomes who had a negative ad that helped him, particularly appreciative of the person who did the negative ad that helped him. And so all of these third-party advertisements are designed to get a helpful hand in Congress.
Mm. I want to have you listen to a little exchange, actually a minute of Senator Grassley. You worked with Senator Grassley for many years, of course, in the other chamber. This is interesting and perhaps a note of hope for us,
mm-hmm,
too.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Grassley saying goodbye to Senator Harkin. He made – this is the last minute or so of a 7 or 8 minute mm-hmm speech he made on the floor of the Senate on Senator Harkin's birthday in November of 2014, and to pay tribute to the senator before he left office. And we remember, of course, Senator Grassley, a Republican, Senator Harkin, a Democrat, from different parties. But listen to this extraordinary bit of testimony, this speech, the last minute of it from Senator Grassley from 2014.
As you start life's next chapter, and I see my colleagues here so I can look at him. As you start life's next chapter, may you enjoy the blessings of hearth and home, health and happiness. Although Tom is retiring from public office, I'm confident he's not retiring from serving the public interest. From one constituent to another, I thank you for your lifetime of public service, and I wish you good luck and Godspeed. I yield the floor.
Senator Grassley in 2014, paying tribute to Senator Tom Harkin and the other party. So what does that call to mind? That's an ideal that we wish for.
Well, it is. And one of the things that by perspective we should keep in mind, Chuck Grassley is by quantum measure the most important Republican senator in Iowa's history. And Tom Harkin, by a quantum measure, is the most important Democratic senator in Iowa history. And the two complemented each other in many different ways in a helpful way for the state as well as, I think, for the national interest. And on certain issues, they voted the same way. And other issues, they were polar opposites.
Mm-hmm. Can we see such a partnership happening in today's era of politics with the hyper-partisanship? Does that still happen?
Well, it can happen. It doesn't very much. And by the way, human nature is an odd phenomenon. Often some of the tensest feelings in Congress are between members of the same party, especially those that come from the same states and have the same political perspectives because they have rivalries.
Good point.
But the partisanship is the awkward one. I want to mention here a note. I'm teaching a course in American governance, and I gave as my assignment to a group of undergraduates. Their first assignment was to read George Washington's inaugural address. Mm-hmm. And he concludes it in a very interesting way. He says to the Congress assembled, I assume that you will not vote preeminently your local interest, and you will not vote party animosities. And then he is speaking to the common good. He says, what should drive you is basically a reflection of your moral conscience. Mm. In other words, don't follow your party leaders.
Don't follow the
big groups in your – powerful groups in your in your area. Follow what's right. And I think this is maybe the most relevant advice ever given to this particular set of problems we're facing in American politics. Washington, and by the way, with words that may have been penned for him by James Madison. That is what he said.
Hmm. Congressman Jim Leach with us in a few minutes, so left with Congressman Leach. We want to add to our conversation. Rachel Rubel is with us, lecturer in communication studies at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Rachel, welcome to our program. Rachel, are you there?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Thank you.
We wanted to add you on to in this conversation with Jim Leach to talk a little bit about some of the areas that you've been studying and the impact of our digital revolution on political discourse. Online news stories that you can respond to online for others to see your comments, what you think of an article or an opinion piece. We have social media, Twitter and Facebook. What has this done, in your view, to political discourse?
Well, it's interesting because, as it was mentioned earlier in the hour, it is a topic that oftentimes we're hesitant to talk about in social situations. So it's oftentimes something that we don't want to bring up around the dinner table or at a dinner party because it is a very it can be a very heated type of conversation. But online spaces like Facebook or Twitter gives us a space where we can talk to others or at least share our perspectives about politics in ways that seem less threatening. And so it gives us that opportunity to...
So we're less inhibited, perhaps.
Yeah, we can be. I mean, not everyone, obviously. But for some people, that might not feel comfortable talking about politics at other places. It might give them a space to do so.
When we talk about civility, though, if you go online and it doesn't take long to find out that there's some pretty mean-spirited comments out there. So civility, does that get a fair?
I agree with you that most of the conversations that we're seeing are not especially civil. Part of it goes back to that idea that oftentimes we are surrounded by messages that are consistent with what we believe or what our viewpoints are. And so that can, the more we're exposed to those viewpoints that are consistent with our beliefs, it actually can lead us to hold more strongly to those beliefs. So we might really pay attention to those messages that follow the candidate that we're in support of or the viewpoints we're in support of. And so we might really hold on to those. The ones that are counter to that, we either dismiss or we might engage in more incivil kinds of ways.
So online interaction, online discourse is not likely to change my opinion, your opinion, Congressman Leach's opinion?
It doesn't appear so, no.
Okay. Of course, when we talk about online conversations compared to, say, face-to-face communication, we're missing all kinds of data. Congressman Leach is in the studio with me. I can see his face. I can see his reaction to what you're saying or what I'm saying. But we don't have those cues in the digital world unless we're, I guess, Skyping with each other, for instance.
Yeah. And so that lack of cues, that lack of someone looking disapprovingly or kind of scrunching their face at us, that's what helps us to maybe feel like more open about sharing information. Even if we get a verbal message back, a written message back that is contrary to it, it's still not that same sort of sense of conflict that we might feel when we're face-to-face with someone.
Mm-hmm. Jim Leach, as you listen to this conversation, we have entered the digital revolution. You and I are not what they call digital natives. We were digital natives, of course, born after the advent of the digital revolution. So what are your thoughts on how this new media, not only 24/7, but highly interactive, and you can find a corner for your particular views somewhere and just stay there, right?
Well, you can. In fact, one of the unresolved aspects of the digital age is whether this is going to bring the country and the world closer together or whether it's going to cause greater ruptures.
Mm-hmm.
And the only advice I give students is if you're a strong liberal, find a conservative blog and also read it. And if you're a strong conservative, find a liberal blog and try to read it. The point being that if one immerses oneself only with what one is comfortable with, one narrows one's own mind. And it's not as much fun, by the way. And isn't it fun to find someone who thinks differently and you can poke holes in it if you want? Or you might even poke holes and then find something that's kind of fills a gap. I mean, it's just a more fun circumstance. But it's also not of trivial dimensions. We know around the world that some groups foster terrorism because of it. We know other groups are getting more knowledgeable about the rest of the world, and it's much more tolerant-oriented. And so we're going to have to see which side is going to prevail, the tolerance or the intolerant, and which side is going to make the greatest impact on history.
Mm-hmm. And that is really a great challenge when you were talking about reading from the opposite or a different part of the political spectrum than you're used to. Don't just simply consume and digest what you agree with. Have something that challenges you. But you were getting to it. How do you do that? Because you can read it in a dismissive fashion. You can read it and attack it, make fun of it. Does that do anybody any good?
Oh, I think it does. I think just to read something, that even if you differ with it entirely, it sharpens your way of thinking. And then it is very seldom that you can read something that is well considered without finding something in it that might temper a little bit the way you think.
Mm.
And tempering is important. One of the things, if you think about the law, there is a trial. And one person sees an event and tells the whole truth about it. Someone else sees the same event, tells the whole truth about it, but they see it very differently.
Yes.
And neither is lying. It just means that their perspective is a little different and their background is a little different and they came to different judgments. And you have to figure that out. And often Americans are wise to learn what the rest of the world thinks about a given circumstance because we might well be advised to think that there are other ways of looking at things.
Right. Rachel, as we wind up this hour, what is your idea about the future of political discourse with continuing media evolution? We fragment into ever smaller bits of sort of churches of thought, if you will, and stay in them? Or does it offer perhaps still that promise of bringing us together in some sense?
I think it depends on what you choose to use it for. So I think the more that we can encourage that exploring of other perspectives, being open to hear other messages, thinking critically through them, then we can find that that becomes a space where much more productive kinds of conversations can happen. If it continues toward a side of simply attacking and simply finding things that are already consistent with what you believe, then that's where the problems are. So I think encouraging, as an educator, right, encouraging my students as well to find those differing perspectives and being willing to listen mm-hmm. is really key.
Congressman Leach, we have about a minute left. Maybe a hopeful note on the way out here. Do you see a path back to more civility, more common purpose, less anger, vitriol, venom?
Well, I think there's a path back, and we shouldn't forget that one of the reasons that there is so much angst in America is that our government has been making some mistakes. I mean, we have been involved in the two longest and most debilitating wars in American history. We had a man-made economic recession. We have problems in the economy that are not providing people as much access to getting ahead as once was available. And so there is reason for angst. And if we can deal with problems in a credible way, I think you're going to have a little better sense of feeling within society.
Mm. Jim Leach, thank you for being with us. Former U.S. Congressman, served Iowa in Washington, represented us from 1977 to 2007. Former chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, now visiting professor at the University of Iowa College of Law. Jim Leach, thank you for making time for us and for coming to our studio here in Iowa City. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Enjoyed being with you.
Rachel Rubel, thank you very much for coming on this program for the first time, lecturer in communication studies at Iowa State University. We appreciate you coming into our Ames studio.
Thank you.
And Iowa Week continues tomorrow. What qualifies as a diverse experience? 20 years ago in Iowa, we were talking about the influx of Latino workers and their families. Today, refugee programs are working with more than 180 different languages and are helping migrants from all over the world navigate culture in Iowa. We're starting to include ideas of sexual identity and socioeconomic status in the conversation. That's tomorrow on this program as Iowa Week continues. If you haven't latched on to it yet, it's very simple. We're looking at major things in our lives through the prism of time. Through the prism of time. We'll do that again tomorrow. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.